wealthy debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand, we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. So we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America. North to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Welcome to another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. We are a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to educate Americans and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. Our guest today is probably going to be controversial for some people. That's because most Americans, if they hear the name Lyndon LaRouche, either don't know who you're talking about or only recall what they've been told. And most, if not all, of what they've been told is likely to be highly questionable at best. But I'm not going to make that case. I'm going to let our guest today, Harley Schwanger, make the case about what is being lied about when it comes to Lyndon LaRouche and why people are lying about it, because it has a lot of important implications for what's going on today. And we need to make sure that people take LaRouche and the LaRouche PAC seriously when they hear what it has to say, he has to say, and it has to say about what's going on right now, especially the current issue that's a burning issue is Syriza, what's going on in Greece, and what that means for the rest of us. So again, with no further ado, here's Harley Schwanger. Thanks for being on the show, Harley.
It's my pleasure, Rick. Good to be with you.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about this propaganda campaign that is several decades old against Lyndon LaRouche. You're a spokesman for him, a national spokesperson, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. You know, I was looking at Wikipedia, which is a highly unreliable source, of course, but usually you can get the gist of the facts of the matter and leave the opinion out until you have a chance to do more research. And of course, Wikipedia is supposed to give links where you give your where they give you some authority for the claims they make. But in the case of Lyndon LaRouche, I noticed that there are a ton of accusations where they don't even bother to link any sources to the accusations. What do you have to say about that?
There's a whole cottage industry that's grown up since the late 1960s, early 70s, devoted to trying to smear and attack Lyndon LaRouche. And much of this is a way of avoiding discussing the issues that he's been raising in his public career of almost 50 years. We've been fighting for what you might call a just economic order. The development of the poorer nations, the uplifting of the people in our nation who have been victims of bad economics for the last 40 years, the move to a post-industrial economy, which has left out whole sections of the population. And in doing so, we've been taking on corporate interests, including in banking and finance and insurance, for years. And as people can judge for themselves from the recent fight over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the corporate side tries to obfuscate and cover up. They don't like people to discuss the facts about what they're doing and to explain what they're doing and why. They'd rather argue over hot button issues, abortion, gun rights, gay rights, things of that sort, and leave out more profound issues about where our nation's going. And LaRouche doesn't do that. LaRouche sticks to the idea that we're fighting against an imperial aristocracy or an imperial oligarchy that has seized power in the United States, especially under Bush Sr., Bush Jr., and Obama. And that oligarchy is, and I can give you the links, the background to show you that this is who is responsible for most of the slanders against Lyndon LaRouche.
Well, that is good to know, because we talk about this power structure all the time, and it's certainly easy to imagine how people might be able to believe these distortions if they don't know that background. And I think pretty obviously anybody that speaks out about the truth about the real power structure, who controls the United States government and other governments, who dictates economic policy, as I think it says on the website, these are global forces. These are not nations. Nations are tools in their hands, and ultimately we're talking about the international banking cartel. This is something we talk about on this show a lot, so that's not going to be new to our listeners, but it certainly gives a context and explains why the LaRouche movement might be so frightening to some people that they would work this hard to attack it.
Well, Rick, let me give you an example, because for many, many years, what LaRouche has been warning about is that this increasing power of interlocking corporate boards and corporate elites is a form of fascism. It was called in Italy initially corporatism. Mm-hmm. This is also what we saw come into Germany with Hitler. The idea that the state serves as an enforcement agency or mechanism for these corporate interests. Now, what do we have today in the United States? We saw it with the collapse in 2008. Instead of real reform and regulation, putting the too big to fail banks through bankruptcy reorganization, bringing back Glass-Steagall, because the too big to fail banks were the ones that got rid of Glass-Steagall in 1999. Instead of doing that, they had an election between two candidates in 2008, both of whom endorsed the idea of the bailouts. And now, 7 years later, trillions of dollars of bailouts, we still have a shattered economy. The banks are 40% larger, the big banks 40% larger. There's a liquidity squeeze for the small regional and savings banks, the ones that fund mom and pop businesses and small enterprises and so on. And as a result, what LaRouche warned about in the late 60s, early 70s, the encroachment of a fascist global economic policy under the control of these corporations. And by corporations, I also include raw material cartels like the oil cartel, the people who control the gold markets, the small number of firms that control world grain trade and the Monsantos of the world and the pharmaceutical industries. These are run by interlocking board members who act in the interests of these global cartels and against the interests of any nation state or people within a nation state. Now, that's what we called fascism, and LaRouche was attacked for years on this. This is where a lot of the argument that LaRouche is a leftist communist comes from, because he was saying that there's fascism.
When they're not calling him a right-wing nut, right?
Well, and if we used to go down the halls of Congress, and one congressional office would say, "Get out of here, you commies," and the next office would say, "We don't want the KKK Nazis in here." And you know what happens when you do that is, where's the discussion of policy?
Right.
Now, if you look at what we have, look at this absurd election that we have now, where you have, you know, a Volkswagen full of clowns on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, you know, there's a little bit of real discussion that gets in, but it's really somewhat muted. But no one is ultimately taking on the corporate networks that are behind the war danger, the threat of a new war with Russia, the fact that the Obama administration has continued the Bush policy of regime change. Who benefits from this? Not the American people. And these things have to be debated. And let me just give you one other example of this. The silliness around the Benghazi debate. The Republicans are showing what fools they are, that they're using this for the 2016 election, not to get down to the truth of what happened in Libya, where the President of the United States, working with the British and the French, killed a leader and destroyed a nation, bringing Al-Qaeda to the fore in that country and ISIS to the fore. And what happened in Benghazi is that there was an arms transshipment from Libya to Syria. It was going to the same Al-Qaeda, ISIS forces in Syria that either the U.S. ambassador stumbled upon or else he was part of. I'm not sure which. But why don't they investigate the real thing and the fact that the president was illegally using his power unconstitutionally to carry out a war without approval of Congress? That doesn't come out in the debate.
I agree. I've said that many times on that exact same issue. The Benghazi gate should really be about why were we supporting a terrorist invasion of Benghazi and assisting this NATO-led terrorist force in taking over a sovereign country and destroying it. You know, most people don't know there were at least 10,000 people killed in the NATO bombings in the name of a humanitarian intervention. How can Americans be so stupid?
I know you know this, and I hope your listeners do, that the excuse given by Cameron and Sarkozy, who brought Obama in, was that they had evidence, they had intelligence, that Gaddafi was about to launch an attack on civilians. Now, Gaddafi was about to launch an attack, but it was on the people in Derna and Benghazi who were affiliated with something called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Shield, which was an organization connected to Al-Qaeda.
And supported by the CIA. And supported by the CIA for years before that.
Exactly. And so, and then when some people in the Senate brought up that we were engaging in military action in violation of the Constitution, that only Congress can declare war, and in violation of the War Powers Act, which says after 60 days you must come before the Congress, it was John Kerry and John McCain who ran cover for Obama saying, well, this really isn't a war. But it was a war. It was illegal. And it's directly connected to the U.S. involvement in Syria to try and bring a regime change against Assad. So, you know, you raise these things and it's inconvenient for the powers that be to have to discuss this. They'd rather say, who's more anti-Muslim, more anti-Islamic terrorist? And they don't want the real issues brought out. So that's one of the reasons, one of the primary reasons why for so many years there have been efforts to silence LaRouche. And if I may, I'd like to mention two names of people who were involved in this, since you do want to get to some of the facts involved.
Absolutely, as long as you can document it.
Well, one of the people involved was Sidney Hook, who was very well known during the student movement as someone who was constantly attacking the anti-war movement as communist. Hook was tied to the anti-communist networks around Commentary Magazine and some of the other what today we would call neocons. And in 1971, after Lyndon LaRouche debated a leading economist in December 1971 at Queens College and just devastated him, Hook put out the word through his networks, Reason Magazine was one of them, that no one should talk to LaRouche because you don't want to give him a platform. And if you have to just identify him as someone who is a mudslinging Nazi. Actually, Hook said as a communist. A few years later, 1976, there was a signed editorial in the Washington Post by Steven Rosenfeld, who was one of the editors of the Washington Post, saying no major newspaper should ever waste any print space covering anything said by Lyndon LaRouche or his supporters. Now, this continued through the 80s when the accusations came out against LaRouche that he was running a fraud operation, an operation to steal money from supporters. Now, no one ever asked why didn't any of those so-called supporters who were robbed come forward and testify against LaRouche. Now, when LaRouche was acquitted in Boston of the charges of a credit card scam, in spite of that, to this day, you'll see slander saying LaRouche was convicted of a credit card scam. He never was. He was acquitted in the Boston case because they couldn't prove it because there was no evidence. This was totally made up. They changed the case to a conspiracy to defraud the Internal Revenue Service, brought that down to Washington, D.C., and that's what LaRouche was convicted of. But to this day, the press will say he was convicted of a scheme to loot his supporters of $30 million. So these are just some examples. And by the way, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who helped LaRouche in his appeal, said that the case against LaRouche, which was largely centered around then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, Ramsey Clark said this was the best example of prosecutorial fraud and misconduct against a man he had ever, by the government, he had ever seen. That's from Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General.
Well, that is certainly impressive. And to our listeners, if you have any doubts about whether the government will go to these lengths to discredit somebody by malicious prosecution, I suggest you go to the three-part series in our podcast files on Jim Fowler, who's been a victim of for years of a witch hunt by the federal government in collusion with certain state prosecutors. And is still fighting the IRS. That's the last stage of his battle to finally be free.
Look at the Snowden case. There's another one.
Well, I'm talking
Chelsea Manning.
Well, those are a little different in my mind because they're based on what are arguably violations of national security. Obviously, I don't want to get into that too much. I think I've already said many times on this show, we need to look at what the definition of national security is before we take sides in that. I agree with you that Snowden and Manning are both victims of a government that's doing the bidding of the forces behind the throne who profit from war and who profit from operating in the shadows. So our whole national security complex is based on the idea that people can't know who's really in charge and what they're really doing. Otherwise, we might demand democracy.
Well, and that's where you, when you look at some of these attacks, you go back and look at Daniel Ellsberg case, where people of conscience come forward and expose these crimes, it usually turns out badly for them. And in the case of LaRouche, he went to prison for 5 years. When he came out of prison, he continued to fight. And the man's 93 years old now, and I think it's interesting to note that his ideas are very prominent in the discussions going on in Greece on how to fight the European Union, with Russia, China, India, and the BRICS countries who were talking about breaking with the IMF. I mean, one thing, Rick, that people can look at if they want to look at a timeline and what LaRouche has done over the years. We first came out against the International Monetary Fund in 1974, when the IMF shifted from its post-World War II mandate to basically maintain a narrow band of connection between fixed exchange rates of currencies, which was ended in 1971 by Nixon. And after 71, because of floating exchange rates, it opened the door for speculators to attack weaker nations. And then the IMF would come in to, as the expert, to give advice to countries on how to become fiscally sound. Now, all the IMF did was put forward policies that allowed for further looting of those countries. For example, privatization, forcing countries to sell off their natural resources. Coming in, this is all documented in the book by Perkins, Economic Hitmen. We were writing about this in the 70s. And this is where you hear this absurd formulation. Well, LaRouche is anti-Semitic because he's against international banks. He believes in a Jewish bankers conspiracy. That's a lot of bunk. There's no Jewish bankers conspiracy, but there are bankers who kill. I don't care what their religion is. David Rockefeller is not Jewish, and we fought against him. Christine Lagarde is not Jewish as far as I know, and she's carrying out policies that are killing people in Greece, and we're fighting against her. Mm-hmm. So there's a principle here that is left out when the slanders and the fog and smoke are put out to try and obfuscate the principle.
Well, let me just make a comment on that, if I may. Some of our listeners may believe that it really is a Jewish banker's conspiracy because so much has been written about the power of the Rothschilds family, who even Ellen Brown and other credible sources says we're behind Rockefeller's rise in the banking industry. So historically, if you go way, way back, Jews were the only religious group that were allowed to lend money at interest. And that became a way of surviving for some in Europe during the early parts of the diaspora, where they were there was so much prejudice against them. And they fed on each other because as these banksters got richer, they became more hated, and they generalized that to the whole Jewish population. But the reality is, it isn't, the like you said earlier, it has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with culture, the broader culture, subculture they belong to. It has to do with the individuals who put wealth and power above all else. That's their only value in life, and that is not confined to Jews by any means.
No, and that's very well said, because what I've often said is that it's true there were what were called the Hofjuden, the court Jews, who were brought in by monarchs to be the instruments of charging interest. And they benefited from that because usury was considered to be anti-Christian. But you know, what I would say is their religion is irrelevant because they don't really worship God, they worship mammon.
Exactly.
It's the idolatry of money. And that's not limited to Jewish people. That exists across the board. You look at some of these so-called Christian fundamentalist ministers who make fortunes by fleecing their flock. So, you know, the real issue here is, are you going to fight for a credit system that allocates funds so that you can develop and build an economy so that all the people who participate can be uplifted? Or are you going to have a system in which the handfuls of people with the money rig the game so that they keep making money while the people who work and the middle class end up as the fleecees?
Absolutely.
And that's what we're dealing with.
We are. And it still amazes me how few Americans realize that what's going on in Greece is a message for them. Greece is a canary in a coal mine. They're being treated the way that third world countries used to be treated exclusively. When they
That's an important point, Rick, because under the European Union, which supposedly was about prosperity and peace, it really was set up as a banker's institution first. and the political side of it was a secondary consideration. Look, I've spent a lot of time in Europe in the last 5 years and have been involved in numerous conferences and talked to many of these bankers, and I know their thinking. Their thinking is that the banks come first, very much like what Hank Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who was Treasury Secretary under Bush when September 2008 happened. Paulson and Geithner, who at the time was the head of the New York Fed, their line was, if you protect the banks, then the economy will follow. Their policy then was a huge bailout, which has continued, much bigger than the original $700 billion in TARP. It's somewhere in the range of $23 to $27 trillion in credit that's been parked in these banks, that's parked back in the Fed, none of which goes into the real economy. Now, in Europe, the original deal to bring Greece into the European Union was rigged by Goldman Sachs. And Goldman sold bonds on behalf of the Greek government to their clients, which Goldman traders themselves shorted. In other words, they made money by voting against or betting against the very bonds they were selling to their clients. That used to be a crime.
Right, but it's exactly what they did with the derivatives. And just to make a couple points about what you said, put it in context for some of our listeners. At the beginning, you talked about a post-industrial economy, and when you're talking about the global economy, what you mean is just what you said about all these debts being piled up that represent money that's not part of the real economy.
Also, and using the debt to shape the policy of nations.
Right, and what the danger? Well, aside from the danger of having that much power by using all this monopoly money to buy off governments, this kind of a financialized economy is, like you said earlier, it's a Ponzi scheme. What the number you gave may not mean much to people about the amount of money out there in debt that the banks supposedly hold. If you look at just the derivatives market itself, it's commonly estimated that that's at least 10 times the world GDP.
It's bigger than that. The latest figures at least. Of the Bank for International Settlements say it's about $700 trillion in derivative obligations. Now, that's a little tricky because a derivative sometimes is what's called a counterparty agreement. You take our trash, we'll take your trash, and we'll allow you to evaluate it at some level on your books. So the face value of the derivatives at one point was close to a quadrillion. For example, Citibank still has $170 trillion on their books in derivative obligations. Now, if you wipe out the so-called counterparty segment of that, you still have somewhere around $40 to $50 trillion that has to be accounted for if the bank is no longer able to come up with cash to back up their paper. Now, that, just for Citibank, that's three times the GDP of the United States for one bank.
Mm-hmm.
And there are six other major banks that are holding large quantities of derivatives. The key to understanding a derivative is it is a Ponzi scheme. That what you're doing is you're betting on the value of something that has no underlying value. It is a bet on a bet, as opposed to the old days with a futures market. If you were betting on the price of soybeans or pork bellies, at the end of the contract, someone ended up with pork bellies or soybeans. With a derivative, there's nothing tangible.
Well, you know, just as a an aside, since you mentioned commodities, I understand that the commodities market is being played in much the same way. Oil futures might represent 300 times the amount of oil currently on the market. How's that going to what if that all gets called
that's,
in?
That's affecting, I'm here in Houston, and I can tell you it's affecting Texas right now, because when the fracking, which LaRouche has opposed, the fracking policy, which the president seems to love, but when a fracking started, the people who borrowed money to make the wells were borrowing it based on the expectation that oil would be at least $90 a barrel. Now, once they started getting the loans to drill, and buy the equipment and so on, these loans became securitized. And so they became a derivatives market on the commodities with the underlying value was oil. But then those loans were leveraged up. So in terms of the present commodity futures, or derivatives, I should say, on the oil wells of the last 5 years, it's estimated about $1.6 trillion is tied up in derivatives on that. And so when the oil price started to fall, it wasn't just that oil companies went out of business or small drillers, independents went out of business because they could no longer service their debt. It's that a secondary market was threatened. And we came very close to a meltdown of several banks, including Bank of America, over the derivatives on the oil deals.
How close did we come? I read that that was a risk. Ellen Brown wrote about that in Web of Debt, or excuse me, in her column. But how close did we come? I didn't realize that had really.
You remember about 5 months ago, all of a sudden the oil started going up again.
Right.
Well, what happened was a shakeout of some of the smaller and new independents, and a number of banks were very close to the edge in Texas, but they were backed up by the larger banks because the larger banks were the ones that did the securitization on this. So I think the Fed was prepared. In fact, you may remember in December of this year, there was an amendment to the Dodd-Frank bill, which in my thinking, the Dodd-Frank bill was a piece of crap. It was a terrible bill. But one of the few areas that was useful was that it was going to end the protection of any commodity derivative contracts that were held by commercial banks. And so in December, Citibank wrote a bill to change that, an amendment to change that. It was backed by people like Jamie Dimon and President Obama, who called congressmen specifically to ask them to vote for the Citibank amendment, which allowed derivative contracts and commodities to be protected by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Oh, my God.
So to change Dodd-Frank. And this is when some of the progressive Democrats, including people like Pelosi and others, Elizabeth Warren, Rose DeLauro, began to freak out about, well, where's Obama going with this stuff?
Well, I think people need to, just in case people didn't follow that, it's really important to get this point. The first point that Harley made was that if you look at oil futures or energy futures, these are being used to turned into derivatives and leveraged, meaning they can be used to generate a multiple of that debt, say 30 times the debt was typical prior to the 2008 crash when they created derivatives. So that means there's a much huger amount that could stand to be lost by these big banks, among them Bank of America. So,
and that's the Ponzi scheme.
Right. So what Harley is saying, you got to understand the consequences of this. If Bank of America fails, it could affect liquidity for everybody in the country, meaning you can't go to an ATM and pull out money to buy your groceries. For one reason, because Dodd-Frank also says that there will be no more bailouts. Instead, Helen Brown wrote about, she really exposed this, I think, there will be bail-ins, meaning the bank will have the right to take your money like they did in Cyprus.
You know, Ellen, on that, we've been in, I've been in touch with her, others in the LaRouche organization have talked with her, and we were the ones who dug out the section of the Dodd-Frank bill in Section 2, which established the principle of the bail-in. But you have to realize, even this is a fraudulent thing, because you think the government is going to let Bank of America collapse? They're not going to let that happen. So they are going to back it up, but the bail-in provisions, and this just got enacted in the European Union as well, and they just bailed in a bank in Austria, the Ipo Alba Adria Bank. What it says is that when a bank gets in trouble, what you thought was a deposit or a savings account becomes a form of debt to the bank. That is, that it's as though you're investing in the bank, and the bank therefore can draw on that money to back up their bad paper.
Right.
And this is in Dodd-Frank. It's right there. And you know, I confronted Barney Frank on this just a few weeks ago down in the, he was in Anaheim, California for the California State Democratic Convention. And I brought this up to him and he said, so what's your point? And I said, well, you basically put at risk the savings and the checking accounts of every single American. And he said, get away from me.
People need to understand that Barney Frank is the head of the House Banking Committee, one of the most popular Democrats in the country because people think he's such a flaming liberal. That's sort of an illustration of how badly the Democratic Party has been taken over by the banking industry, as was the Republican Party many years ago.
And Rick, the reason to bring these things up is that when your listeners look at Greece and say, well, that seems pretty bad, but it's over there, it's not over there. The money that the Greek government supposedly owes is bailout funds that were loaned to the Greek government to pay back the banks from earlier debts.
Mm-hmm.
It's the equivalent of someone in your audience buying a mortgage on a credit card. Every monthly payment on the credit card only increases the amount of debt that you have because it's debt plus interest. You never pay down the debt.
Well, now, isn't that the same thing that happened in the United States when we bailed out the banks? All they were doing was using that money to pay off their debts to other banks or to use it as interest-free basis for loans.
Well, interest-free money to speculate.
Right, right, to
because
speculate.
Here's the thing that didn't happen. This is what LaRouche said should have been done in September 2008. Number one, a moratorium on foreclosures. Actually, he proposed that in 2006, that people who were working and trying to keep a house over their head shouldn't be penalized because they had a fraudulent mortgage drawn up for them by a bankster. Secondly, you have to reorganize the banking system through first Glass-Steagall, which would separate commercial banks from investment banks, which would simply mean that no bank could use any of the liquidity from depositors or checking accounts or any other kinds of accounts for their speculative function. If you want to speculate, you have to do it on your own nickel. If you're a commercial bank, a depository institution that in which deposits are protected by the federal government, then you can't speculate with that money. And then point number three, with the investment banks, which those banks that choose to remain investment banks, they have to write down their debt to market value, not face value. Because what happened during the mortgage-backed securities bubble, the speculative bubble from 2001 to 2008, which was a Bush bubble, what was done was huge volumes of funny money or phony obligations were created. And had they been priced at market value, you would have had a blowout of the banking system. And so you needed Glass-Steagall to protect the commercial banks. But instead, they were loan money so that if they had the equivalent of a margin call, they would be able to have liquidity to back up the bloated and ridiculous values they were keeping on their books. Now, what happened after 2008 is they were not forced to write that down. They were given more money, which under quantitative easing found its way into the stock market, mostly through large players, including corporations borrowing at 0% to buy their own stock.
Right. So or at most
the stock market bubble, which is being called prosperity.
Right. I think you explained that really well, but let me just put it another way for people that might not have caught the whole thing. What you're saying is, we recapitulated the great stock market crash in 1929, kind of, in the sense that there was all this money put into the stock market then on margin, meaning, again, leveraged, meaning you put in 10% and it's supposedly your stock is worth 10 times that. But if you can't pay it, it's not worth that because it drives the whole price of the stock market up.
Just one thing on that, Rick. The other part of that was the housing bubble. What the housing bubble did is convince people that your house was worth more as an investment than it was as a place to live. And so people were sold, besides the people who couldn't afford the mortgages they were signed up for. You had the other problem of people who had maybe paid off half of the house or two-thirds of the mortgage or even paid off the whole house and were convinced that now instead of a $100,000 home, it's a $300,000 home, so you can borrow $300,000 against the house, and don't worry, the price will keep going up. And so people had this artificial view of their net worth. And so when the housing bubble popped, all of a sudden people were paying off debt that they should never have taken on. Now, when these houses were foreclosed, the banks took them over. In many cases, they waited a little while. One of the things that's happened in the last year, last 18 months, is that hedge funds are coming in and buying foreclosed homes in huge quantities and then putting them on the market as rentals. And part of the reason it works for them is that people who lost their mortgages, who were foreclosed on, can't qualify for a mortgage again. And a mortgage is usually cheaper than a rental property.
Mm-hmm.
Now people have to rent. And there's even something that's been created called rental derivatives. So they're repeating the same fraud over and over and over again. And not a single person who was involved in this whole scam, this Ponzi scheme, went to prison.
That's another really, let's take a step. Let's stop right there for a second. I want to say that's one of the most important points people need to understand about this whole thing. Now, the Obama administration periodically would come out and charge some corporation with a crime and say, wow, look at this, we're getting serious. So the corporation might get convicted. Most of the time, they never had to even admit wrongdoing, but the only penalty was to pay a fine. No individual, the people who actually made these decisions, was put in prison, like you said. Without that individual accountability, you can't expect anything to change.
This was called the Holder Memo. Eric Holder basically argued that if you started jailing bankers, it would wreck the confidence of the country in the banks and would lead to a banking collapse because the system was still too fragile. So therefore, what they did is something called a deferred prosecutorial agreement, where they would charge Bank of America, or take HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, one of the largest banks in the world, that's been laundering drug money for 140 years. HSBC was caught repeatedly laundering drug money, and they repeatedly were given a $1.2 billion or $4 billion fine with no one going to jail. These same banks were involved in the so-called LIBOR fixing, the London Interbank Overnight Rate, where they were selling something called credit default swaps, which were basically insurance on bonds. I'll take a perfect example. Jefferson County, Alabama, the city of Birmingham, wanted to redo their waste management system. They borrowed something like $60 million to do it. They were forced to buy these credit default swaps as part of their original bond offering. And what they were told is that if the interest rates go up on their bonds, that the company that sold the swaps would pay the difference. But if the interest rates went down, they would have to pay the difference. Well, then these same banks that sold these bonds illegally connived to lower the interest rate to collect the money from the groups like Jefferson County that bought the bonds. And that's why Jefferson County, Alabama is in bankruptcy right now. Now, did anyone go to jail for that? That's a perfect example of a swindle.
Well, and that's really important. People need to understand that is in addition to the fact that when you publicly finance infrastructure projects, it can end up costing 100% more or more than what you would have paid if you had done this with an interest-free loan, such as from a public bank. And Ellen Brown, again, has pointed this out many times. That's how they do it in Nebraska, and that's how they should do it everywhere. But the problem is the capture of the United States and state governments by the banking industry. I bring this up partly because one of the things that Lyndon LaRouche also led on was proposing a public bank, a national public bank, decades ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've been a long-time proponent, rather than doing it on a state-by-state basis, which Ellen Brown proposes, largely because she doesn't think it could happen nationally. But our view is you have to fight this nationally. They're not going to allow states to opt out of the Federal Reserve System. So what LaRouche proposed is you put the Federal Reserve System through a bankruptcy reorganization, because the only purpose of the Federal Reserve System is to protect the money center banks and to make money on lending, making credit available to the federal government. Now, if you had a Bank of the United States along the lines of what Hamilton proposed, or the greenback policy of Lincoln, or even the attempt by John Kennedy in 1963 to go to Treasury as the U.S. Treasury is the source of credit, then it's the government which is making the credit available. Now, the problem is that we have, because of the neocons, the Austrian school, the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman, all these free market lunatics, their view basically is that government will mess up everything, so government shouldn't be trusted when it comes to money. You have to have a total free market system. As we've moved more and more to a free market, we're seeing that a free market is anything but free. It's totally controlled from the top. What Hamilton understood as the first Treasury Secretary is that you had to protect people from private speculative interests. That was what the American Revolution was fought about. The whole idea of the British East India Company controlling the credit and debt of the colonies. Instead, if you put it, now this is where you run into some problems. What Hamilton said is it's up to the Congress to legislate what the credit should be that's made available through the bank. Now, most people don't trust the Congress today, but that's our own fault because we keep electing idiots and corrupt people. If the American people understood that the banking system is our inherent right to control for the good of the nation, and that we have to be up on these things so we can elect people who can be trusted to make these kinds of decisions. We've had it a few times in our country's history, and it's worked, but we tend to get very negligent when there's prosperity, and we allow the wrong people to come in the back door, and next thing you know, you've got another speculative bubble.
Wow, you know, you're the first person I've heard make that comment that a lot of this is due to the fact we became ignorant when we were prosperous. I've had that belief for a long time. Now, what you're proposing is that we spend our efforts educating the public so that they will demand the politicians be accountable, and we'll vote for the ones who indicate that they will be. The objection I hear to plans like that, they're based on most on education, is the fact that, well, in our current system, the only way you can elect people is to choose among people who are backed by the corporatocracy, by the big money people, who are ultimately backed by the banksters. And so if that's the case, it's hard to see how we're going to elect these people unless we reform campaign finance. And that's why one of the themes we talk about on this show is a constitutional amendment that would seriously reform campaign finance, ban corporate campaign contributions, and give Congress the power to regulate or abolish private funding of campaigns. Has LaRouche addressed that issue?
Well, our view is that we should go more toward the European system, which is pretty much what you described. First of all, the election campaigns are not 2 years, but they're 3 weeks or 4 weeks. Secondly, it is public financing. It is access to all parties that can show some support, that they can get access to the media, fair and equal treatment in the media. You've got to do something like that. But just step back for a second, because how are we going to get to that point? We're facing a potential cataclysmic financial crash in the period immediately ahead. It could be triggered by the Greek crisis, because this is going to affect foreign exchange derivatives that in turn will threaten banks like Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas, Royal Bank of Scotland. those banks are closely integrated with the American banking system. All this talk about how sound we are is a lot of poppycock. The U.S. banking system is in terrible shape. Now, under these circumstances, we have to have voices like yours where there are chances to get this the word out on this so that people actually who want to know can find out what the reality is. Now, then we need a movement of people, of citizens, who will fight for these simple ideas like Glass-Steagall, like regulated banking, like a credit system through a national bank. This is something that everyone should learn in their civics classes in junior high and high school. But it's all been taken over by this post-Nixon period, neocon, University of Chicago School, free market thinking. Now, that free market thinking is about to crash. The fact that the International Monetary Fund has to admit that they were completely wrong in everything they prescribed for Greece, which is now coming out in memos that were leaked to the London Guardian and the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany, is now all over Europe, that the IMF was wrong about Greece and the Syriza government was right that the debt was unsustainable.
Now wait a minute, did the IMF admit being wrong? I mean, isn't the IMF controlled by banks who actually profit from this or
of
have?
Of course, but you see what happened. Look, some of the people who do these things at the top are just evil bastards who are out for their own benefit. Some of them are just bureaucrats. And people at the IMF wrote a report which was honest, but it was a private secret report, which basically said, look, this Greek debt can never be paid back. And this was given to several people in the Bundestag in Germany, because there's a special committee of the German government that's been working with Merkel on how to deal with the Greek situation. And two of the members of the German parliament, when they saw this, were so outraged, they leaked it. And so the IMF was forced to come out and say, yes, we did really have this study. Now, this isn't new. About 8 months ago, the IMF admitted, the chief economist for the IMF admitted that they underestimated the problem in Greece. But then what did they do? They said the solution is the same that we've been doing. More austerity, more cuts in pensions, and so on. So even though they'll admit they made a mistake, they won't change what they're saying. That's why they're so upset about the Greek government. And to bring this back to what we started with, Rick, if you look at the press, what are they saying about Alexis Tsipras, the president of Greece, and the Syriza party? They're saying they're a bunch of leftist communists who are against the European order, who are against democracy. They're a fringe government. Well, I hate to tell you, they got elected democratically, that they have the support of their people, and that they're fighting a fight that should be supported by all Americans. And so, again, instead of taking up the issues that the IMF lied, Merkel lied, Cameron lied, the EU is corrupt and immoral, instead of that, what they're saying is Greece, the Greek people are lazy, they get paid too much, and the government is a leftist government.
Yeah, and they never talk about the suffering of the people due to the austerity measures. You want to comment on that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, look, Greece has had its economy shrink 25% in the 5 years of IMF policy. That's not unusual. The IMF has done that to Niger. They've done it to Somalia. They've done it to countries all over the world. But the Greek government, 25% shrinkage in GDP. 26% unemployment officially, and 60% youth unemployment. The pensions have been cut by 40%, and these were not really high pensions. The average pension in Greece now is 400 euros a month, which is about $450. The Greek government is being forced to sell off the railroad and sell the islands that they have, which are part of their income from tourism. And this government said no more. Their health system has been destroyed. Many of the elderly are dying. The death rate where the average age of death is dropping. It was 76, it's now 72 for men. The suicide rate is up 36% in Greece. So they've taken a modern country and destroyed it. And now when that country elected a government which said enough is enough, the bureaucrats, the unelected bureaucrats in Brussels are saying, well, they're proposing something undemocratic. Excuse me, a referendum is undemocratic?
Well, you know, the latest story is that they said, regardless of the output of the referendum, the intention is to get rid of Tsipras. They're not going to release the funds unless Tsipras and the finance minister resign. Did you read that story?
Sure. And what they're doing now is that the operatives of the European Union and some people from the PASOK party and the New Democracy party in Greece are going to these people who's desperately standing in bank lines to get their 60 euros a day. And they're saying to them, if you vote no, that is for the government in the referendum, the banks will stay closed and you'll have no access to money. So they're spreading lies and disinformation against the government to try and win the vote on Sunday. Now, whatever happens with the vote on Sunday, if the Greek government wins, that is, if there's a no vote, they're saying they're going to go back to Brussels to renegotiate. Merkel and the IMF are saying they're not going to renegotiate, which leaves the Greek government in a situation where they may have no choice but to exit the euro and hope that they can get some support from the BRICS countries, including especially Russia and China, both of which have been meeting with the Greek government. The Chinese are talking about major investments in the port of Piraeus. The Russians are talking about the transshipment of oil and gas through Greek ports up into Europe, because the EU shut down the Bulgarian plan because of the sanctions against Russia. So there are options for the Greeks. Going back to the drachma would not be the worst thing. The problem is that there's a convenience with the euro, and they do think that it makes tourism easier and other kinds of trade issues easier. But what they're finding is that ease comes with a very harsh price. And it may be that if the Greeks exit, which means they default on their debt and they leave, what's Spain going to do? Already Podemos, which is the party in Spain, which is allied with Syriza, just won 2 weeks ago the mayor races in Barcelona and Madrid. In Italy, there's a huge reaction against the Renzi government, which is cutting pensions to the bone. Even in France, they're now talking about a Frexit. France forced to leave.
We got about 1 minute. Let me just comment real quickly on France. France, of course, it was one of the most successful democratic socialist governments in Europe. Unfortunately, they are ending up the same way. They're suffering austerity measures. Their unions are under attack, and yep. Union membership is dwindling. They're basically falling victim to the same thing. And they are not organizing either, because they did too well for too long.
But they're fearful. They're fearful of what happens if they break with the banks.
What they're saying
is the banks are bankrupt. Let's have sovereign governments put them through bankruptcy reorganization instead of killing people to protect the banks.
Exactly. And that is the point I wanted to get to. This is how we'll have to end the show, is that what's happening in Greece, it's threatening to happen in all these other countries you just mentioned, Spain, Italy, France, and it's coming to the U.S. We're already being subjected to austerity measures. We've already been ripped off by the banksters, and next time it's going to be much worse. That's all we have time for today on Taking Back America, but I want to thank again our guest, Harley Schlanger, and we're going to have you back on to talk some more about this, Harley. Thanks. That's it for this week. Join us next week.